It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The debate you hear in American farming today between organic and what's called conventional farming arose in the early decades of the last century. With the development and marketing of chemical fertilizers and pesticides, farmers learned that using these could bring them higher yields and lower pest problems. But there were always those who worried, concerns about the health effects of pesticides on produce and the environmental impact of so-called agribusiness. And that worry grew in the 1980s and 90s as the public's desire for organic food took off with double-digit increases for organics. Now today, organic is more popular than ever, but with increased popularity often comes increased scrutiny. And in the past few years, that's been the case with organic food. Studies in several scientific journals question whether organic food really is that much better for you and whether it's the answer to feeding a hungry world. These reports have led some to call for a move beyond organic, a synthesis of the best that both forms of agriculture have to offer. Today in The Exchange, we continue our week-long series on food in New Hampshire, Eating In. This hour, the debate over organic. Let's hear from you, too. Do you buy organic or not? What's leading you to make that choice? Do you grow organic or not? What's behind that choice as well? Also, on a broader level, do you think organic could help address our world's environmental and food woes, or has its promise been oversold? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests have both looked at this issue for many years. We're joined by Elliot Coleman, longtime farmer and advocate for organic farming, author of numerous books, including The New Organic Grower, and co-owner of the Four Season Farm in Harborside, Maine. Elliot Coleman, a real pleasure having you. Thanks for your time.
Hi, thank you.
Also with us, James McWilliams, Associate Professor of History at Texas State University, author of several books on food and agriculture, including his latest, Just Food, Where Localvores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. And James McWilliams, a big welcome to you, too. Thanks a lot for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, and gentlemen, before we get into some of the issues, let's just establish what we're talking about here. Elliot, when I buy an organic carrot or an organic package of cookies, what am I getting?
Well, at the depends on whether you buy it in the supermarket or whether you buy it from a local grower. If you buy it from a local grower, you probably know the person, and you can find out very quickly what sort of growing techniques that person uses. If you buy it in the supermarket, then you're dependent upon the statutes that the USDA has set up, and maybe those aren't quite as good, but basically what you hope you're getting is food that has not been sprayed with pesticides and has been grown on land that has not been doused with soluble chemical fertilizers.
And James, anything to add to that?
No, I mean, that's a great distinction. The what I might add is you're also, when you're buying organic, I think you're certainly, depending on the grower, you're getting a philosophy too. You're getting a different approach to the soil. You're getting a different philosophical approach to agriculture. In many cases, not all cases, but you know, going beyond the standards themselves. I think you know, when we buy organic, particularly on a local small scale level, we're getting a different philosophical message as well.
Well, and both of you know, we're bombarded with labels when we go to the grocery store. And Elliot, I wonder, do some companies claim their foods are organic when they're not, or is the definition pretty strict and you can't really get around it?
Oh, I suppose there was some of that activity back before the regulations were legislated, and I suspect, as you would find in almost any industry, there are those who would probably treat the regulations more lightly than others. But that's why I always go back to your local grower. It's really nice if you can go to the farm, meet the people, see how honest they are, and then you'll probably have a better chance of determining the quality of your food.
Mm. And, you know, Elliot, as I said in my introduction, the demand for organic food has been quite impressive in the past 10 to 15 years. Both of you, Elliot first, what's behind those growth numbers?
Oh, I sus- expect after all the chemical scares that show up in the newspaper every day that the average customer out there is wondering if maybe they should be making decisions that would lead them to be safer, whether those decisions are entirely correct or whether the press has whipped up a scandal that doesn't exist is always worth talking about. But I think that's what's motivating the customer.
Chemical scares like ALAR on apples and so forth.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. What do you think, James?
I think that's part of it, but I think there's another element to it as well. I recently went back and looked at some literature from the 1990s on fertilizer. And, you know, I was really shocked because I found several articles, scientific articles, arguing that, you know, the best approach to fertilizing would be a combination of organic and conventional methods. And I found that to be really eye-opening, primarily because you wouldn't find that today. We are in a much more polarized environment, and, you know, it's either all organic or all conventional. And any synthesis or combination of those methods is really difficult to find today. And I think what that reflects, getting back to your question, is a kind of ideological reaction to the growth of agribusiness or industrial agriculture. Of course, agribusiness and industrial agriculture have been with us for a very long time, but it's really in the last 10, 15 years that it's become a mainstream concern. And a lot of consumers, again, as Elliot suggested, are turning to organic, whether, you know, this is a legitimate or accurate response to agribusiness or not is an open question. But they're turning to organic agriculture as an alternative, as a more pure alternative to eating supposedly safer food.
Well, and those are some of the themes that you get into in your new book, Just Food, James. And I do want to talk to both you and Elliot about them. Let me invite our listeners to join us, too. The number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're continuing our week-long series on food in New Hampshire, Eating In. This hour, we're looking at organic food, whether they are all they're cracked up to be, what's behind the rise in organic, and some new research showing that there may be some expectations that you have with organic that are not exactly accurate. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. If you buy organic, tell us why. If you walk past the organic aisle at the grocery store, tell us why. And also on a broader level, do you think organic could or could not offer some solutions to our environmental problems, to our hunger problems in the world? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And, you know, James, in your book's chapter on organic, you first off say you have huge respect for Elliot Coleman. You got copies of his books on your shelves. But, James, you say that organic is a model of food production burdened with, and I'm quoting you, misconceptions and unacknowledged limitations. Misconceptions, James, such as?
Well, you know, I will often hear consumers say, I buy organic because it's chemical-free. And, of course, this obscures the fact that a lot of chemicals, often very potent chemicals, are used, particularly with big organic production. And they just happen to be natural chemicals. And so I spend some time in my book going through some of the authorized chemicals that, you know, organic users are allowed to spray on their crops. Simply, and again, I really want to draw an important distinction here. I do this not to in any way undermine organic agriculture. That's not what I'm trying to do. I have tremendous respect for organic agriculture, and I admire its approach to soil quality. But at the same time, I think we have to be reminded continuously that growers, particularly large growers of organic produce, need resort to chemicals to help them battle fungal growths, insects, and, you know, they need fertilizer inputs and soil additives as well to help increase their yields, just like conventional farmers. And so I'm just laying that out and saying, you know, organic agriculture right now is a very small percentage of production, but if it did become, say, 20, 30, 40%, would these chemicals that are used in organic agriculture become more of a problem?
So are they quote-unquote less dangerous chemicals, though? I mean, James, is that what people expect when they get organic?
Well, it depends on your perspective. The number one leading cause of agricultural injury in California is organic workers breathing sulfur dust, which they spray as a fungicide. You know, it's natural sodium nitrate, which is used as a soil additive, leaches perchlorate into the soil. You know, I don't know if I really am comfortable getting into a comparison of the dangers of natural chemicals versus synthetic chemicals, primarily because it ultimately comes down to how these chemicals are used. And this is a point I make repeatedly in the book, and one where I try to get beyond the organic conventional distinction. To me, when it comes to using chemicals in agriculture, and I've just studied this, I don't practice agriculture, but my sense is that it's far more important to look at how those chemicals are applied. Are they applied with precision? Are they applied responsibly rather than what chemicals are used?
And are they applied to the soil, James, or are they applied directly onto the plant themselves? That's a concern for people.
Oh, it depends. I think that if it's a fungicide, I believe it's applied to the soil. I think there are many organic pesticides that are applied directly to the crop itself. But I think that's a question that Elliot could probably answer a lot.
Well, Elliot, yeah, and this gets into what you have called, and I've done some reading of your work as well, deep organic versus shallow organic. Go ahead, Elliot.
Well, I want to preface this by saying that I also have great respect for James as an independent thinker. But what is causing his confusion is what I would call limited familiarity with the subject. To use a metaphor here, someone whose only familiarity with automobiles is a demolition derby would logically have a distorted view of their role in transportation. The difference between shallow organic and deep organic is that, yes, there are many ideas that have been allowed into the USDA standards, but they are not the best practices. And the growers out there who are using best practices are using none of the chemicals that James has mentioned. And I think that it's really important to understand that whereas a new idea may have begun in a certain way, it is continuing to develop, and this idea is definitely continuing to develop. When I first went to visit European organic farmers back in 1974, it was a totally different game.
And I'm going to jump in there, but I will let you finish up that thought. I apologize. After a short break, we'll let you finish up, and we'll take some calls, too. So stay with us.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from UR members and from Company C, experimenting with color, design, and texture to create products that add a touch of the unexpected. Designs for colorful living online at companyc.com. From Synergy Health and Fitness Center in Exeter, providing a year-round healthy fit, now offering ballroom dancing classes, personal training, and acupuncture. SynergyFit.com, the art of wellness. And Franklin Savings Bank, a mutual savings bank, providing banking, investment, and insurance services to central New Hampshire since 1869. Information at fsbnh.com. More on eating in, the organic debate on The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, a setback in the fight against AIDS. New Hampshire weather for today, mostly sunny in northern parts of the state, partly sunny in the south with a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Today's highs, upper 60s to lower 70s statewide. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, more of our week-long series on food in New Hampshire, Eating In. This hour, we're looking at organic food, and we welcome your voice in our conversation. Call in 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We have two guests, James McWilliams, Associate Professor of History at Texas State University, author of several books on food and agriculture, including his latest, Just Food. Also with us, Elliot Coleman, longtime farmer and advocate for organic farming, author of many books, including New Organic Grower, and co-owner of Four Season Farm in Harborside, Maine. And Elliot, just before the break, we were talking about the difference between what you have called deep organic and shallow organic, and whether the big organic guys do use chemicals on their products. Go ahead. You want to finish up that point, Elliot.
Yeah, well, I really don't know what the big organic guys do use because we don't use any of them. We use no pesticides at all, not because we're opposed to them, because we have no need for them, because when you grow plants correctly, the pests are no longer a problem. But the important point to make here about the difference between chemical and organic is that I do not believe that organic farmers have caused any problem like the dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico, which are a result of excess chemicals flowing down the Mississippi, nor are there residues of, say, rotenone or some organic pesticide that James might object to found in Antarctic penguins. So we're talking about systems with far different effects on the planet in the long term.
One of the criticisms, Elliot, of organic is that it's not practical for today's world. I want to read you an email. This is from Stan. He says, local farms produce far less product per acre in a more inefficient manner than factory farms due to older and less modern equipment and methods. This causes far greater carbon footprint in spite of the transportation involved for product from factory farms. He says studies I've read from the U.S. to England show no value to organic farming at a cost of up to 50% more at the market. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, New England was 70% farmland and 30% forest. Today, New England is 70% forest and 30% farmland. Stan says, do we really want to go back to the early 1900s? I think his broader point is that organic may have worked once long ago, but it's not practical for a world with 6 billion people. What do you think, Elliot?
Well, what you had once long ago wasn't organic farming because, I mean, I've heard the argument that organic farming caused the Dust Bowl because all farming was organic back then. Well, that's ridiculous. What caused the Dust Bowl was bad farming practices, no matter what you do, plowing up the prairies. The quality of what we grow, I believe, and obviously our customers believe, is higher than the quality of what they can get in the supermarket, which is why people pay more for it, the same way you pay more for a Mercedes than you pay for a Yugo. But the main reason we continue to farm this way is it just plain works better. And as far as strain on the planet, I mean, our main fertilizer, which I think is the world's best fertilizer, is called compost. And compost is made for free on our farm from waste products. I mean, that's about as self-sufficient and as future-oriented and as sustainable as you can get.
You know, James, I want to bring you in on this, too, real quickly. What about the concern that you can't feed a hungry world with organic farming?
Well, I think we're dancing around an issue of scalability here. And, you know, while what Elliot is doing works extremely well on a small scale, I do question how scalable it is. Can you take it to larger and larger levels and feed more and more people that way? I want to get back to the issue of, you know, organic agriculture. It certainly has not been shown to be connected to dead zones, or certainly has not been shown to be, you know, killing wildlife the way organic practices are. But we have to keep in mind right now that, you know, organic agriculture, I think 0.7% of the agricultural acreage in the United States is under organic agriculture.
What was that percentage, James, again?
I believe it's 0.7, a very, very small amount of acreage. And so the question I have is, you take something like manure, and manure is you know, either composted or not, is a standard fertilizer used by organic growers. Now, one, manure has many, many benefits, obviously, as a fertilizer, but one drawback is organic farmers use manure to get nitrogen. That is, they measure the amount of manure that they're going to use to get the right amount of nitrogen to grow the crop that they're growing. The problem is phosphorus levels are very, very high when you just peg your manure amount to nitrogen. You get excessive levels of phosphorus, which have been shown repeatedly to leach off the land, especially if you're using if you're tilling that land, which most organic growers do. So we don't really know what kind of impact organic practices would have. Would they have a negative environmental impact? I think it's quite possible if it was scaled up. And so, you know, I think this is an issue we need to keep in mind as we're discussing the great benefits of organic agriculture. Is, you know, they work best on a very small scale, and if that's the case, can it be replicated to the point that we can all eat organic food? Can it be replicated to the point that the price comes down? I think these are important questions.
Well, speaking of the small scale, let's go now to Larry Pletcher. He's owner of The Vegetable Ranch, a certified organic producer in Warner, New Hampshire. Larry, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, just why did you decide to go organic, Larry, with your farm?
Well, you have to understand, I've been doing we've lived here for over 30 years. When we first moved here, we bought a place in the in the country, a nice place, and I was growing food mostly for myself and my family. And it just seemed to me that I didn't want to be putting poisons into my soil and into my water and into the air around the house. And so I wasn't even aware of organic certification at that time, but to me it was the way to go. Also, now we call it something different, but back then I was concerned about being a little more self-reliant. I didn't want to be paying out money to good folks like Monsanto and Dow Chemical and others to afford the chemicals to grow vegetables for myself. So I was growing it produce for myself, quote, organically, before I was aware of the organic program. Eventually, in the late 80s, I was first certified organic, and we started to do some market gardening. And then about 9 or so years ago, we went full-time with that. So we've grown from about 2.5 acres 9 years ago to something like 18 or 19 acres under cultivation this year.
Well, and Larry, you and I have talked before.
Right.
Have there been times during perhaps a difficult farming year where you wished you could have reached for some kind of chemical help?
No.
No.
It's not worth it. I'm interested. The issue of scale, which you've been talking about,
right,
is an issue that is very much on my mind most of the time. As I say, we've had tremendous growth in the acreage that we cultivate over the past few years. And let me point out in response to Professor McWilliams that it's not only organic farmers that use manure to fertilize fields, but obviously we have a few cows, but they can't fertilize 18 or 19 acres. There's lots of other ways to provide fertility using green manures, cover crops, nitrogen-fixing legumes like field peas and summer alfalfas, which we do on a larger scale to provide fertility to our soil. So we're not leaching out phosphorus from those green manures and on a number of different fields that we operate.
We have been talking about the quantity. Obviously, we talked about the quality, but the quantity. What does going organic, Larry, mean for the yields you can produce? Could you produce more if you weren't organic or not?
I don't think so. The research that I'm starting to see suggests that, you know, after some sort of transition period of a few years, if you're going from conventional to organic, that in time the organic will actually outproduce. I mean, it stands to reason that if you're pumping, you know, artificial chemicals and poisons and killing off your soil microbes growing conventionally, that if you suddenly in 1 year want to transition to organic, you know, that's not going to work immediately. You need to build up the soil. You need to have microorganisms in the soil that are healthy. You have to add compost to make your soil healthy. But once you do that, I think organic is going to outproduce conventional.
Well, and last question for you, Larry, please. You know, as we look at feeding 6 billion people and growing in the world, some people are saying, let's do a synthesis of the best that organic has to offer, the best that conventional has to offer, and perhaps we can feed the world's hungry that way. What do you think about that as somebody who's been involved in this for 30 years?
Well, when you talk about pesticides or fungicides, or, you know, I don't know how you do that just a little bit and get away with it and still maintain the organic integrity of the soils. The whole point is having healthy soils and maintaining that health. And I don't think you can do a little bit of fungicide or a little bit of herbicide and maintain that. So, you know, my response to, well, organic can't feed the world, well, let's try it. You know, let's try it on a scale of building up our local farms, our local agricultural infrastructure, and see what we can do. I don't think there's going to be any harm done.
Okay, and we talked about that agricultural infrastructure a lot yesterday on the Exchange.
Right.
I hope you caught that, Larry. It's good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
That's Larry Pletcher. He's owner of The Vegetable Ranch, a certified organic producer in Warner, New Hampshire. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones. Natalie's calling from Marlboro. Hi, Natalie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I really appreciate your last caller, by the way. I really appreciate somebody who can take the time to grow organically. I've been growing organically in different states throughout the country for about 15 years, and it takes more time than growing conventionally, there's no doubt. You see a bug, you know, a conventional farmer will go and just pick up a spray and spray it. whereas an organic gardener will try to find out what's wrong, because when your plants are sick, it's probably something inherently wrong with the soil, or you're growing at the wrong time of the year or something of that nature. I do think that organic has to stay local, though. I don't see it going the way of big factory farms, because it can't be done that way. One of the problems with big factory farms is that they're growing only one or two crops, and they don't rotate their crops, and they don't have flowers and herbs mixed in to bring in the beneficial insects, which you can do on a smaller scale. So I think that we need to, keep the organic, again, with the local farmer, keep our soils healthy. And I'd really like to see more people out there growing stuff in their own backyards and doing it organically. It's a lot of time and it takes a lot of patience, but I think the payoff when you taste what you're growing makes up for it.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in, Natalie. What do you think, James McWilliams?
Yeah, I mean, I want to address a number of issues, both Larry and the recent caller. Maybe I can do this together. I think we have to be careful about assuming that any farmer who uses a synthetic chemical is somehow automatically irresponsible. I mean, the vast majority of conventional farmers that I've interviewed, most of them in the Midwest and in California, have, I would say, a very deep environmental concern with what they're doing. So the frustration is they have little incentive to behave in an environmentally sound fashion. And what makes me nervous about a kind of idealistic take on organic, as in we should all grow more of our food on our own, or organic growers should never even consider using a synthetic chemical, or as Larry said, there's no such thing as using a little bit of synthetic chemical in a responsible way. What makes me nervous about that is it's so alienating to the 98% of conventional growers in this country who have strong environmental ethos. And so my question is, wouldn't it make sense to ask, how can we take conventional agriculture and make it more responsible without asking it to go organic? In other words, what if we looked very closely at precision farming, only using chemicals when they needed to be used, or slow drip irrigation systems to manage water, or using fertilizers that release their nitrogen in a more accurate way, or as the previous caller just suggested, encouraging big growers to diversify. There are ways that we can have substantial gains within conventional agriculture without going over to the organic label that I think need to be pursued. And so what makes me nervous about this kind of all organic, all local or nothing is it really alienates farmers who grow conventionally from undertaking those improvements.
Well, Elliot, I know you have some thoughts on that, but I do want to spend a few minutes now talking to another New Hampshire farmer. Joining us now is Richard Houston. He's a dairy farmer who, along with his family, owns the Pine Lane Farm in Hopkinton. And Rich, real nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Good morning.
And as I understand, you have made the decision not to farm organically. How come?
Well, I've attended about three organic meetings concerning dairy farming, and the reason that we chose not to go organic is because converting to the organic standard is a four-year process. It's very expensive, especially the last year of feeding organic grains would require us to take out loans because we're getting paid conventional milk prices while having to convert to the organic standards. We'd also have significant stranded costs because we'd be forced to downsize from our 200-cow herd down to about 80.
Why would you have to downsize, Rich?
Because the pasturing requirements would take most of our land.
I see.
We would have a lower carrying capacity on our forage production. So we would have to downsize. So our barns, our silos, our milking parlor would be all too big for us.
So you'd go out of business, basically, trying to achieve this standard.
Right. We wouldn't be able to recover hundreds of thousands of dollars.
You mentioned the costs of being organic, and yet Rich, that consumers will pay a higher price for organic milk. So what did you find out when you crunched the numbers there?
Well, a study came out in 2008 done by Cornell University and the University of Wisconsin, who was working with UVM and University of Maine, showed that organic farms don't make much more than conventional farms when you figure in their higher costs of production.
Was this about dairy farms or all organic farms?
It was, I think, about dairy farms.
Yeah. I wonder, was this a hard decision for you, Rich, or did it become pretty obvious pretty quickly?
It became obvious pretty quickly, but one thing you have to consider is that we're a family farm. You know, my mother, father, sister, brother-in-law work here, and it's a group decision. And unless everybody agreed to it, you know, we couldn't do it.
What were some of the other changes that you would have had to make, Rich? You mentioned you would have had to have bought organic grains, which were more expensive. You would have had to reduce the size of your herd because of pasture requirements. What other changes would you have had to make if you had gone this route?
Well, the organic fertilizers have restrictions, calcium nitrate, like your speaker mentioned. There's restrictions on how much of that you can put on. So our farthest away fields that we would normally put commercial fertilizer on, we wouldn't be able to put enough of the regular, the organic fertilizer on. Also, our veterinarian can't use traditional medicines to take care of the sick cows, so we'd have to rely on herbal or alternative medicines that haven't been FDA approved. But for me, the most important reason was the retail markups on organic milk in the stores. You know, traditionally, grocery stores are getting organic milk for about $3.50 a gallon, and they're marking it up to $8 or $9. So,
wow. Somebody's making a profit there.
So I don't know if I want to be part of that.
Wow. Well, how much do you see these days, and I'm talking pretty recently, Rich, New Hampshire consumers more interested in buying local milk than organic milk?
I think that's the area that New Hampshire farms are probably going to go towards. We're hearing lots of talk about people putting in processing plants for milk and for cheese.
Mm. Any more final thoughts that you want to leave us with, Rich, on the decision that you had to make here?
Nope.
Okay.
Almost up.
All right. Well, good luck to you. I know dairy farms are struggling.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. You know, real quick, Elliot Coleman, what do you think about Rich Houston's experience? I know you're more of a produce guy, but what do you think?
Oh, I think he probably for himself made the correct decision. It's an economic decision in that case. And whether that has any application in general to what we're talking about, I don't know. I wanted to go back to that idea of using a little bit of chemicals and a little bit of organic.
Right,
and
the all-or-nothing mindset that James talked about, yeah.
Yeah. In the 40 or more years I've been doing this, I've never seen any need for any of those products. What I've seen is a lot of advertising trying to convince farmers that nature is inadequate and that these products will do the job. But we've been growing some 35 or 40 different crops, both in the field and in the greenhouse, for 40 years. And I've never, as I said, seen any need for those products.
All
and
right.
On that other thing, you know, I don't know whether chemical growers are doing their job well or not.
Elliot, I need to jump in. I so apologize. We'll be back right after that break. Stay with us.
Today on Word of Mouth, mention genetically modified organisms and out come the protesters and the bullhorns. April Davila is no activist, just a science writer, mom, and conscious eater who decided to go a month without eating anything produced by ag giant Monsanto. I'm Virginia Prescott, belly up for a GMO-free Word of Mouth today at noon on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from UR members and Heinemann, a publisher of professional resources and a provider of educational services for teachers, kindergarten through college, located in Portsmouth and online at Heinemann.com. And from Soloway and Hollis, providing effective representation for estate planning, domestic relations, and family-owned businesses throughout New Hampshire. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, our series on food in New Hampshire, Eating In, continues with the pros and cons of local food production. We'll look closely at localism tomorrow on The Exchange. Email us your questions, comments, or personal experiences before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for that. Today, the debate over organics and what role they should play in our food system. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Elliot Coleman, just before the break, and I'm sorry I had to cut you off, we were talking about James's point that he said, wouldn't it make sense to take conventional agriculture, ask it to be more sustainable without going all the way to organic? James has been repeatedly concerned about what he calls this all-or-nothing mindset. Go ahead and finish up your point there, Elliot, and then we'll go to our callers.
Yeah, well, I was just saying that I've never seen any need for any of those products, and that what we are producing, doing what we do, is incredibly popular with the customers we have in the area. Parents have told us that our carrots are the trading item of choice in local grade school lunchboxes, that their children ask them, honest to goodness, ask them to buy our spinach and our salad. And so whether there is research yet saying that there is a difference or that there is anything happening, I would tell you that the eaters around here are very convinced that there is some difference.
Could you take it? Larry Pletcher addressed this to Elliot. Could you take organic global, so to speak? Larry said, let's try it.
Oh, I agree with Larry. Let's try it. And it may be that small farms are the wave of the future. Maybe it is more difficult to do this on a large scale, although I have visited and gotten to know many 1,000-acre organic farmers in the Midwest who are doing a very good job of it.
All right. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Let's go to where next? David's on the air. Hi, David. Go ahead. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an organic farmer, certified organic farmer, and I wanted to address the issue of whether or not organic can supply enough food to feed everybody, because that's been a little glossed over. There was a study done at the University of Michigan, and they did they surveyed 160 different studies. This was Professor Catherine Badgley, and she compared organic results with conventional agriculture in the developed world and in the developing world. And what she found was that in the developed world, organic met or exceeded conventional production in vegetables, grain, and fruits. But in the developing world, it was much higher yields across the board. For instance, starchy roots, which are a main food source, 2.5 times as much with organic, and vegetables and fruits, 2 times as much. And the reason is simply the points that have been alluded to, that soils have been depleted in many parts of the developing world. Organic agriculture is not really just about pesticide-free or not. It's about building up the soil, which makes healthy plants. So that's the point. The other issue was raised, could it be done on a large scale? The Rodale Institute has done a 22-year study that found that after the 3-year transition, organic matched or exceeded conventional agriculture. And in drought years, which are, you know, with climate change, you have it's not so much, we don't know if it's global warming, but certainly climate change, they get up to double the yield. So when you have a healthy soil, you can get through the hard times on a small scale or on a large scale and in the developing world.
Well, Dave, it's great to hear from you, especially since you have your hands in the dirt yourself right there. What do you think, James McWilliams?
Well, I would just caution listeners to about that Michigan study. It came under a tremendous amount of scrutiny. The authors used several conventional measures as conventional yields, as organic yields. Many results were repeated, more than once, twice, 3 times. It really was a controversial study, so it wasn't the end. It wasn't the final word on the issue of yields. But more importantly, I think arguing over yields or getting too wrapped up in this question of can organic feed the world is a bit of a red herring, because comparing organic and conventional yields is an incredibly difficult thing to do, because it depends on the location, it depends on the crop that you're comparing, it depends on a wide variety of climatic factors. It's very difficult to do. And I'm inclined to say that organic yields are on the whole lower, especially given that the vast majority of crops that we grow globally are, things like wheat and corn and sorghum, oats, barley, which do have lower yields. I mean, a University of Leeds study just a few weeks ago showed that if you look at wheat and barley and oats, you have a 55% lower yield for organic agriculture. I'm not terribly concerned with these studies, though, because what really matters is the fact that organic agriculture right now is a very small percentage of the food that's produced. Sure, it's growing by leaps and bounds, but we're still talking under 10%. So I think we have to say, look, how can we improve organic? How can we improve conventional? I think if we get wrapped up in saying, should it be one or the other, we're just going to talk ourselves in circles and never actually see any real environmental gains in the here and now.
Well, David, thank you for calling in. And let's take another one. This one from Elliot, Maine. Troy's been waiting. Hi, Troy, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, Troy.
I just wanted to say that I really like this idea of finding a middle ground. I think that there's no reason to force people who are growing totally organically to grow any differently. But, you know, the simple idea that because something is natural, it automatically is better than something that, you know, humans have come up with, I think is a bit naive. But I think that we should have maybe a third designation that, you know, shows that people are trying to grow with low environmental impact but may not be following the exact standards of organic farming.
Interesting. Troy, thank you for calling. Boy, we keep returning to this theme, Elliot. You know, is there a third way in between these two that might solve some of the problems we've talked about? What do you think, Elliot?
Well, the organic farming is changing and improving, and hopefully chemical farming is doing the same thing. It may be, following what James was saying earlier, we will end up with something in the future purely called farming. And however it comes about and whatever its parts are, one would hope that its ingredients are not as detrimental to the well-being of the ecology as the chemical inputs of present-day chemical farming are.
Here's an email that relates to what Troy said and raises a whole nother host of issues that I want to share with you, gentlemen. Doug in Loudoun emails in. He says, in terms of farming, the key to a better environment is more of a focus on sustainable practices. I am referring to those practices that conserve our soils, water, and all of the inputs that are used to produce a crop. For example, Doug says, by using GMO, genetically modified crops, we are able to use less herbicides and also less tractor time per acre. Doug says we are saving on fuel for the tractor, saving on manpower, and putting less pesticide on the crop and into the ground. Boy, guys, we've done whole hours on this, but what do you think real quick, Elliot?
Well, the GMOs are one of the great myths of the modern world. And if you want good research that doesn't say anything good about that, it was done by the USDA itself in Beltsville by a researcher named Autour Matou. And he was comparing crops grown on a vetch mulch organically compared to ones grown with chemicals. And what he found was that the ones grown organically were consistently higher yielding and had less disease problems. And this was because, and this was the fascinating thing about it, the genes for resistance did not turn on in the plants grown in the chemically fertilized sections. The genes did not turn on.
As they were supposed to.
As they were supposed to.
James, your very quick take on GMOs and whether that's part of the third way that you're looking for.
Well, I dislike everything about GMOs the way we're using them right now. I mean, we're using them to grow crops like corn and soy that are not fed to people. We're feeding them to animals. We're feeding them into ethanol plants. We're putting them into processed foods. That's very bad for us. One thing I do like about GMOs is their focus on density of production, producing more food on less land. And given, you know, the projected global population growth to 9 billion by 2050, I think this is a legitimate concern. The trick here is to actually figure out ways to use this technology responsibly. And I think there are ways to do that. Don't have time to go into it right now.
Right.
But
I appreciate that. And like I said, we've done whole hours on this topic. But I did want to touch on it because of the email. I'd also like to turn now to a major grocer here in New England. Joining us now on the phone is Michael Norton, Director of Communications for Hannaford Supermarkets. He joins us from Maine, where the company is headquartered. Michael Norton, nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Well, when did Hannaford start including organic products in its offerings?
I mean, we've been in produce. We started actually as a produce wholesaler, you know, 127 years ago. So we've always had organic product. I think the change is that consumers, particularly in the last decade, have become tuned into wanting to know which of your products is organic and which is not, because I want to be in control of those decisions.
And I think I noticed at my local Hannaford's, what, about 10 years ago, you started the Nature's Place, where all the organic products are listed. Is that correct?
It goes back even farther than that, in terms of having a called out section in the grocery aisle that is Nature's Place. And now, of course, we have Nature's Place products, which is an effort to provide more organic and natural products at a better value.
What questions or comments do you most often get from customers, Michael, about organic products?
Some people are trying to learn more about where to start, and there's, you know, sort of good guidance there, and some of it depends on motivation. But, you know, speaking of the people that are motivated primarily by concern about whether it's pesticide residue or other health-related concerns. You know, some might say, you know, where do I start? if I'm going to be paying more, I might want to start with those produce items that may be more prone to have that residue. So they want to, you know, we've provided information on that, you know, certain vegetables are more prone to that than others. If it's more about taste, they might be looking for a recipe, saying, you know, what's the best value? You know, in season is huge. That's going to help you avoid. It's going to help with taste. It's also going to help avoid in terms of any kind of residue from pesticides. Less likely if you're buying in season. So they're talking to the produce manager, and they're kind of getting information about where to start. They might be talking to a nutritionist in store and asking, you know, what's the value in this if I do go organic? But most come pretty well informed to start, and they may just be confirming that we have the product they need.
How much of the overall food dollar spent at Hannaford's roughly is organic? I mean, is it 2% of what you sell, Michael? Is it 1%? Is it 5%?
It's you know, well into the approaching, you know, kind of double digits in terms of share. But more interesting than that, it's growing. In the grocery aisle, it's growing double digits year over year.
Oh, wow.
And that's been true even when the economy, you know, became challenging a couple of years ago. So strong both in produce and in the grocery aisles, and particularly in the grocery aisles where, you know, as we found more opportunities to have some private brands that are not as costly, you see people you know, taking full advantage of that.
Well, speaking of the cost, I have an email here that I wanted to share with you, if I could, Michael. This person says, I'd love to buy and eat organic food, but I can't afford it. I'm willing to pay 1.5 times supermarket prices for organic food, but not double or even triple. This person says organic food is for the rich.
Yeah, I think that's been a concern of ours. Even since we started the Guiding Stars Nutrition Navigation Program going back 4 years now, we've been really hard on this message that you really shouldn't have to pay more to eat healthy. And the way we've managed that is by increasing the number of private brands that we offer ourselves that really, while they might be somewhat more, they certainly wouldn't meet the standard of being double, they're less than the national brands. So it's getting better. There is a difference. I certainly wouldn't try to pretend that there isn't, but it's getting better, particularly if you look for those Nature's Place brands. And produce, if you're selective and you really are informed, and you say, you know, I really am concerned about apples, peaches, sweet bell peppers, celery. Maybe I'm not as concerned about, you know, avocados or some other products I don't buy as regularly, and sort of make some choices that way. There are ways to manage the fact that on the fresh produce side, it sometimes is more expensive, and that's largely a matter of supply. But you know, that's changing too. I mean, more and more growers are seeing the opportunity with organic. So we don't know where it's going, but it certainly is. You know, we're hoping that the price differential narrows, and certainly in private brand, it has.
Okay. Well, Michael, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Michael Norton, Director of Communications for Hannaford's Supermarkets. And Elliot Coleman, James McWilliams, just to wrap up with you. Elliot, you've been involved in this for a long time, as I said. Where do you see this discussion going in the next maybe decade about whether organic can feed the world, whether there's a synthesis between conventional and organic? What's your prediction, Elliot, for how this is going to shake out?
Well, I suppose in the long term, if oil supplies are going to run out, and I suspect they will at some point, that a system of agriculture based on needing large amounts of such products is probably going to have a hard time continuing. And organic farming, which is based on getting most of its inputs from the natural world or through management such as crop rotations, is probably going to be the system that we end up angling toward.
So anything based on petroleum could be on the way out, Elliot, which spells good news for organic, you're saying.
Oh, I don't think it spells good news for anybody, but as far as I can see, it is probably the reality of our world, whether it happens in 10 years or 100 years. And I think that would probably be what's determining the course of agriculture.
Very interesting. James, give us your 5-year or 10-year window on this.
Quick take. Yeah, I'd like to see more of an emphasis on organic becoming more sustainable, on conventional becoming more sustainable. But more importantly, I'd like us to get beyond the organic conventional distinction and start asking the question that Michael, the grocer, just brought up, which is, you know, how do we eat more healthy, and do we have to pay more to do it? And I think the answer there is no. I think that the more we turn our diet, our national diet, away from processed foods and away from meat-based products towards more plant-based diet, we're going to see our costs go down, whether we're buying organic or conventional, and we're going to see the health benefits go up. So I think we need to pay just as much, if not more, attention to what we're eating as we do to how it was produced.
Right, and in your book you say, and we won't get into it now, James, but in your book you say we should consider meat more like caviar with little sprinklings here and there.
Yeah.
All right.
Final point is I'm bringing my kids up to Elliott's Farm, and if he can get them to eat carrots and spinach, I'm converted.
Guys, it's been such a pleasure having you. James McWilliams, thank you so much.
Thanks.
James McWilliams, Associate Professor of History at Texas State University. His newest book is Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. Elliott Coleman, it's really been nice having you. Thank you.
Oh, and thank you very much for having us on. It's been a great discussion.
Elliott Coleman, longtime farmer and advocate for organic farming. One of his most famous books is The New Organic Grower. He's also co-owner of the Four Season Farm in Harborside, Maine. By the way, many of you did not get a chance to get on the air today, but we do want to hear your thoughts. You can post your comments online at nhpr.org/exchange. So we do want to hear from you, nhpr.org/exchange. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The producer is Dan Enkeles. Our intern is Sarah Crane. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy. And thank you, Sarah, for everything you have done. Today is Sarah Crane's last day with us. She is so smart. She's going on to Dartmouth after this summer. We will miss her terribly. And Sarah, best wishes in all your endeavors.